Good morning and welcome to Taking Care of Business. I'm Jackie Mitchell. Good to have you with us today as we have some spirited guests talking about the entrepreneurial spirit. I have not one, but two co-hosts today, as our panel-styled show includes Darren Woolley and Toby Travener. We're also joined by two other entrepreneurs, Jared Carman and John Nikvapil, as we find out the keys to their success. Today's show, as always, is brought to you by our good friends at eView Real Estate. Now, you hear it all the time from famous entrepreneurs, long before they were running multi-million dollar companies. They were flexing their entrepreneurial skills by selling lemonade on the corner, building gadgets in their garage, or hosting weekly ping pong tournaments at college or university. It seems that behind every successful mogul is a kid who grew up knowing they were born for business. But what exactly is it that sets entrepreneurs apart from the rest? What is it that makes them tick? What is it that makes certain people believe in themselves enough to take the prospect of failure head on and have the determination to come out on top? It takes a special kind of person to set an idea in motion, riding the highs and lows from humble beginnings to ultimate success. So it really got me wondering about today's show, and I thought, what a great topic to talk about those elements of success. It is a term that's thrown around, I think, a bit too much these days. And I'm ably assisted today by my special co-host, Darren Woolley. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jackie.
Toby Travener, always good to have you here.
Nice to be back. It's funny how Darren and I actually work in the same building, and our offices are directly opposite the corridor.
Three metres away from each other.
That's right, but it takes your show to bring us together because we never see each other.
You're too busy.
But it was an absolute fluke because I know you independently, and then I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great to get those two on together? Wow, fireworks will be going off in the studio as Rab's camera is clicking away as well. And we're also videoing today's show as well, thanks to Toby. So I thought getting them together, and then I find out the two of you know each other and then you share the same office.
Well, I think we avoid each other.
You may be avoiding me, Toby, but I know exactly where you are.
Oh, okay.
The stalker.
Oh, yeah, the stalker.
You're an oversharer.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Actually, that's a good point about what some entrepreneurs do. They're very good at actually talking about what they're doing and letting people know about it.
I was going to ask you about that. Would you describe yourself as an entrepreneur?
Part of me says yes and the other part of me doesn't. I think one of the key success factors of an entrepreneur is this feeling of what the hey, I'll take the risk. Mm. And because my early years were in a corporate area, my risk kind of management strategy is a little bit more corporate rather than entrepreneurial. But I know people who are very successful who just go, you know what, let's try it. And if we fail, make sure we fail quickly so that we can do something else. And that's a spirit that I see often.
Darren, you've talked about that before, about failing fast.
Yeah, look, I would say I'm a stronger entrepreneur than I am a business person.
Really? Why is that?
Because the day-to-day running of the business is something that actually bores me to tears. And the constant innovation and trying something new is actually the thing that gets me up in the morning.
Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? Do you think it's a term that's thrown around a bit too much these days?
I think anybody can be an entrepreneur. It's easier and easier to do that. And in fact, if you look at the way the stats run, small business in Australia makes up something like 28% of the economy. So it's very, very easy for people to start a business. To be successful in it, I think, is a lot harder for most businesses. And I don't know about your experiences. As I look at the rest of the panel, how many businesses fail within a year? Then how many make it to the next milestone, which is 3 years? And then probably to the next milestone, which is 10. And if you took 100 businesses, I wouldn't be surprised if there's one in 100 that makes it through to 10 years.
And I'd challenge the idea of what an entrepreneur means.
Yeah.
Because I think what it's come to mean is a successful small business person who has built a business to a medium or larger size. But I think entrepreneurialism is actually, as you said before, Jackie, taking the risk. You know, creating something new or creating a new category or creating a new business idea and taking it to market, willing to fail. Because there are a lot of successful small business people that are successful in categories that are already established, and where really just following the rules of that category properly will make you successful, you know, because they're established businesses.
Yeah.
But entrepreneurialism is more than that. It's actually creating something new and creating value out of that.
I thought it was always good to start with definitions. So I thought I'll look up the definition of not just an entrepreneur, but entrepreneurial spirit. Mm. And I'm interested at that. That's that word spirit for lots of reasons, the gin and tonic. But anyway, no, moving on. The entrepreneurial spirit is a gift that inspires others to become the best they can be. From passion and positivity to leadership and ambition was one descriptor. There were many descriptors, obviously. That was one. But that was one that actually hit home to me. And it was interesting the term of the use of the term gift as opposed to skill. Do you think you're born like that, or is it something that you learn along the way?
It's interesting, isn't it? I think it's who you surround yourself with.
Okay, yeah, good point.
A lot of that, and you do hear of a lot of entrepreneurs saying, surround yourself with like-minded people or people who will support you rather than find a reason to knock you down or why it's not going to work. And it's that whole kind of yes-and behavior rather than yes-but behavior. And I work with a couple of guys who are very entrepreneurial, and they're large business now, and that's the thing. They're a property development and wealth advisory company with close to $750 million of worth of assets under management. So they're a big company. And their father-in-law, two brothers-in-law, married to sisters, and their father-in-law still thinks that they're taking too big a risk.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh, you don't want to do that, mate. You want to go into that area? So I think a lot of entrepreneurial kind of spirit, idealism and so on, is based around people supporting that idea. And to a certain extent, it can be born, but I think a lot of it's to do with the nurture side of the equation rather than just the nature side.
And I think that's true in the fact that a lot of entrepreneurs come to entrepreneurialism later in life. So if it is a gift, it's a gift that can be discovered. It's not necessarily a gift that you're endowed with at birth. It's not like someone waves a wand and goes, you'll be an entrepreneur. Because, you know, I spent the first 40, 30 something years of life, you know, working for other people. And not really driving this entrepreneurialism. Suddenly, a realization that I can actually back myself and be willing to do that unleashed a lot of the attributes that you already have as part of your personality into a business environment.
Where did that realization come from, Darren? Like, did you just wake up one day and a light bulb went off, or did you have a key influence? Was there a person you were working with which gave you that little bit of a bit of a push?
It was a combination of things. The first was a frustration with seeing everyone in the category I was working in doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different output.
Yeah.
The second was seeing other people that had backed themselves and going, well, I don't have anything I don't have, so why don't I, you know, give it a go? Mm. And the third was getting to a stage of life where it was, I'm either going to do it or I'm never going to do it, and do I want to die having never tried?
Okay. But that's a certain mindset.
Yeah, of course.
So you obviously were born like that, do you think?
We're back to that.
Yeah, well, I think there's some, maybe it's a combination.
I think it's about risk management again, and it's whether you're at the right stage of life or wherever to say, you know what, I'll take the risk. And there are some people who'll never want to do that. They're so risk averse that they'll stay in their good job, earn their salary, get their superannuation and retire doing, you know, the trip around Australia.
Yeah, I think that's the norm, isn't it?
It could be, but you look at generational differences, and we've got millennials who've just hit the marketplace, and the younger Gen Ys. Although I was having a chat with one of the Victorian Young Person of the Year, as an example, who's a very strong animal rights activist. But he's, I'll give you an example. He says, look, our values are the same. You know, we want to be secure. We want to have good lives. We want to look after it. We want to have a family and so on. But this focus on a fulfillment of an outcome is very strong for them. So it's about passion fulfillment. So they're willing to forego some of the other things early on in the piece in order to do that. And it literally is, I'm going to do something. I don't know the rules. I'm choosing not to know the rules or not to follow them. And I'm just going to give it a go. And out of nowhere, he's raised $1.5 million through crowdfunding and so on.
Toby, it is generational because, you know, before the war and even up to the Second World War, it was all about security. And if you were going to be an entrepreneur, you usually came from money. You know, when you look at all the early 20th century entrepreneurs, they came from large, wealthy families, and so they were able to indulge the risk. But I think baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, have increasingly seen the opportunity to take control of their destiny and to question, what is my purpose? You know, it's not just about being a cog in the wheel. It's about actually reinventing the wheel becomes a real opportunity for people.
Yeah, I think Toby's point earlier about surrounding yourself with support, because I think having that entrepreneurial spirit isn't the norm. So you do need that support, because you're going to get the majority of people going, oh, don't do it, it's too risky, because I think by nature human beings are risk adverse. But it's interesting you mentioned that, because someone said to me once to surround yourself not only with people who support you, but people that are better than you. So you never become comfortable. You're always taking that step up. I'm actually living that right now with my guest here on the show. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. It is coming up to 20 past 11. We hope you're enjoying eavesdropping on our interesting conversation here on Taking Care of Business. Our spirits are very high today, as we are now joined by Jared Carman, who has had many professional incarnations. Jared, welcome back to Taking Care of Business.
Thanks, Jackie. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here. Would you describe yourself as an entrepreneur?
Not really. I don't describe myself as an entrepreneur. I'm just someone who's not afraid to have a crack.
Oh, and but surround isn't that part of it?
Yeah, I guess so. I just surround myself with people crazy enough to follow me on the journey.
Okay, that's interesting. And do you surround yourself with people better than yourself?
Sure do. Yep. That's the key. Surround yourself with people better than yourself.
Yeah, look, I've come across a manager. We were talking in the break about how large organisations can still have an entrepreneurial spirit. And this guy's a relatively senior manager in a large firm. And he says, my job is to hire people better than me, and then point them in the right direction.
Ah, that's a good tip. That's a pearl of wisdom, Toby.
Well, but the thing is, though, Darren and I were talking earlier, it's the issue is a lot of people don't want to hire people who are good because they don't want to be shown up.
Yeah, they want to control the outcome.
Stupid. Yeah. It's just stupid. Anyway, moving on. Now, Jared Carman, your interesting career, where did you start?
Started out as a psychologist, really.
That's right. Psychology. I remember. Fascinating. Yes. Yeah.
But I think it started for me when I was about 14 years old. Mowing lawns, and then I put out a flyer, no job too big or too small, and I had people trying to get me to landscape the whole front yard, so I outsourced that to other people.
See, that was my introduction about having a lemonade stand or starting your own business. They're all little clues there, so you might be a bit more entrepreneurial. Anyway, so moving on, so then you're trained to be a psychologist. Why?
I think originally to try and woo girls and get girls to follow me home.
Yeah, that's always. But you know, it's all about motivation and drivers. It works for you, yeah.
And then I went snowboarding the planet, went travelling around the world, which was interesting.
And you were teaching snowboarding?
Mm-hmm, sure was.
Were you competing as well?
A little bit, yes. Yeah.
How'd you go?
Did okay. Tend to trip over on the fall line a fair bit.
Yeah.
On the finish line. But I surrounded myself with amazing people there too, and some very wealthy people that we're doing great things.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned sport, because I always have a view that business can learn a lot from sport with the whole technique of particularly sports psychology and visualization, training your body and your mind, and it's almost equal.
And being competitive.
So what did you learn from working in sport into how that's translated into business now?
Well, to not be afraid to have a go at things and surround yourself with a good team.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so you've been psychologist snowboarding, and then what happened?
I decided I wanted to be in real estate. Just had an epiphany, and that's what I always wanted to do.
Why? How did that happen?
I met some real estate agents in America, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it would seem like a great thing to do, and it was just in the back of my mind, and I wanted to help people, not being in psychology anymore. I wanted to help people, and I figured real estate was a way to get into people's lives. And it's one of the most emotional transactions people make.
And so you're using all those skills you've learned along the way, and you're still in real estate now.
Sure am.
You're with EVU Real Estate, who proudly support this program.
Yep.
So it's always good having you on. Thank you very much for that. So how long have you been in real estate now?
8 years now.
Yep.
But we opened up the office 12 months ago. We had a team of 4 people.
That was in Mornington?
In Mornington, yep. Yes. We've now got a team of 24 in 12 months.
Wow. Wow.
It's been amazing growth.
And that's incredible, particularly in a highly competitive market. I mean, there's a real estate in every corner.
About 16 in Mornington.
16? Goodness me. How many on the peninsula, do you know?
I don't know the numbers, but...
Yeah, high.
Lots.
And so what elements from your transitional journey, particularly I suppose the psychology would be helpful.
It has been helpful, yeah, but it's to be not afraid of trying new things, doing things differently. We use a fair bit of video and just things. I want to be able to see the future and be able to adapt to that future, and it's going some amazing places. Virtual reality is an amazing thing that's going to change the industry.
Where do you get your ideas from?
My strange brain.
Oh, okay.
And studying other people. Yeah.
Well, you're in good company here with strange brains. Did you have a mentor or a hero that you sort of looked up to or that encouraged you or supported you?
There's a few out there. I've always taken influences from different people. John McGrath's huge in the industry, but I've got two coaches at the moment, Glenn Twindle and Aaron Sansoni, and they're helping a lot.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask you about having a business coach. So you've got two. Why have you got two?
For different parts of the business. One's more real estate focused.
Yep.
And one's more life and sales focused.
And what do they do for you?
Inspire me. Mm. Give me fresh ideas, new ideas. Okay. I bounce ideas off them.
Yep.
And a bit of strategy. Yeah.
Now, that's interesting. Darren, do you use a coach?
No, I don't.
Have you ever?
I tried a business coach once, but we parted ways because I found I was uncoachable.
Oh, why is that, do you think?
Because I actually find talking to lots of people and learning from a wide range of people, I found getting one person's point of view, I kept questioning whether that was actually the right point of view, which is not that helpful when you're paying for a coach.
It's interesting. So then you go, well, do you be the coach? But then you've got someone like, I'll go back to my sport analogy, someone like Roger Federer, you know, the best tennis player they're saying ever, and I would sort of tend to agree with that actually as a bit of a tennis fan, and he still has a coach. So you think, well, the best in the world still has a coach. So there must be something in that. Do you think that's the end of the road for you for coaching? Oh, come on, there must be someone out there that can handle you.
Certainly from a business perspective. And before I said, you know, I'm more focused on the innovation rather than business.
Yeah.
But what I found is you can actually hire business people.
Right.
You can actually hire someone to run the business and tell you how to run it more effectively.
Yep.
But you can't hire someone to tell you how to innovate, because actually innovation comes from you as the founder and the leader of the business.
And Jackie, it doesn't actually have to be a capital C coach. It doesn't have to be somebody that you hire and bring in. I think one of the issues for any entrepreneur is that loneliness of trying to come up with the innovation yourself a lot of the time. And the act of interacting with somebody else, even if their job is literally to tell you what's right in front of your nose because you can't see it because you're too close and it's just a fresh pair of eyes. I'm a little like Darren, but rather than being uncoachable, I change my coach often. I'll use them and go, thanks for that. Bye now. I'll use somebody else. Yeah.
It was actually my coach that told
me
I was uncoachable.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that was their way of justifying me firing them.
So that's really interesting.
but the thing is, you don't actually need to have somebody. You can have an intellectual community.
Yeah.
And so the fact that the four of us are talking at the moment is providing coaching service to each of us.
Great point. That's a great point. I hadn't thought of it like that. And also, it's all about your style, isn't it? How it's going to work for you. Because coaching's about getting inspiration, learning, and there's a variety of different ways we can do that.
So I think if you are sitting in a business and you're so focused on running the business, then you definitely need to take active process to get input from lots of different people or a coach. But, you know, my day-to-day life is getting out and talking to people in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And that's where 1,000 ideas come from.
You're getting that inspiration anyway.
From lots of people and a very diverse range of ideas.
And dare I say, when somebody says you're uncoachable, they're actually saying, I'm unable to coach you.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, that's it. Right. And I think with particularly with Darren and yourself, Toby, the variety that you have in your day-to-day work gives you so much stimulation from your environment that probably helps with that side. Now, what I want to do is talk about elements that make up an entrepreneur. And I'm going to start off with the word passion. And I was thinking about entrepreneurs that demonstrate that. And the one that popped in my head really obviously was Richard Branson, because not only is it passion for business, but a passion for life. And then I started thinking, hang on, Toby, you've interviewed Richard Branson.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So did that come across when you interviewed him about his passion for business and life?
You know, it's interesting. We see Branson as being the very brash, out there, extroverted individual. But that's the brand.
Mm.
That is the brand Branson. And he does the stunt for the good of the brand and whatever business he's on. He's actually an introverted thinker. Mm. And he's very, very much a person who will disappear on his island.
Yeah, of course, as you do.
as you do. But I'm sure he sits there and does a lot of thinking. He'll surround himself again, with people who he can bounce ideas off. But he's a great thinker. Once he's got that idea, though, that's when the passion comes into it, and he won't let it go. But he changes that idea.
Right.
Once it's become operational and there are better people for him to, you know, to use to be able to run it.
Yeah.
It's boring now. I'm going to do something else. And his current two areas, we talk about Virgin Galactic. Yes, it's great. We're all going to, you know, go into outer space somewhere along the line. But his two areas right now are Virgin Unite, which is his charity, and Virgin Oceanic. So he wants to go to the deepest part of the ocean. And that's, again, him sitting in the co-pilot seat of a submarine this time. And that introverted behavior comes through. But it takes a lot of passion to drive something and look, a lot of money to drive something like that, yeah, as well. And Darren was right in the comment in the past, which was the people who are entrepreneurs had the money to be able to risk the outcome. What we're finding today is that passion overshadows it. And in the beginning, I'm happy to, you know, eat cheese and macaroni as long as I'm getting out there and doing things. And I'm seeing that the next generation is much more prevalent towards doing that.
I like a link. Always. And I found out just before the show started, we're talking about Richard Branson, and Jared said, you're going to be on stage with Richard Branson later in the year. Please tell us more.
Yes, in September I'm speaking on the same stage as Richard Branson. It's about the Titans of Real Estate. So that's a real estate conference.
Where's that?
Up on the Gold Coast.
Oh, so he's coming to Australia.
Or Brisbane, yes.
How fantastic.
Yeah, it'll be exciting.
So what sort of preparation do you do for that?
I've got to prepare my speech, obviously, and prepare myself nervously because there's be quite a few hundred people there.
So you're speaking at the same time, like you're sharing the stage with him?
Sharing the stage. Right. I think I'll go on before him. I would say he's going to be the headline act. Yeah, so I'll be on stage.
So it's not a panel style?
No, certainly not. So but I'll get to meet him.
You'll get to meet him.
Yeah.
Have you got any questions lined up to ask him?
No, not really. I think I'd like to just have a reasonable conversation with the guy. But he sounds very introverted, and I've heard he's quite difficult to get information out of.
Toby, can you give Jared any tips?
Well, pick him at the right time. Mm. You know, I found him when we were preparing. This was for a summit about 4 years ago. And I'm getting myself ready. You know, mentally, I'm a little on edge here because I'm about to interview Branson. I could do the right thing. And I see him across the other side behind stage, and he's pacing up and down. And he's more nervous than anybody else is. So if you can pick a moment when he's kind of not about to go on stage, being calm and so on, he's actually very, very generous with his time and advice because he gets it because he was there one time as well.
Now, hold that thought. It's time for a bit of a short break and have a quick glass of water. And we'll be right back after this with a really interesting entrepreneur we're about to chat to. Welcome back. Our next guest has reached the higher ground. That, of course, was the wonderful Stevie Wonder. He has reached higher ground many times, coming from business royalty. His family started the iconic 4 and 20 Pies and has been described as Australia's manufacturing economist. John Nekvapil, welcome to Taking Care of Business.
Good morning. How are you, Jackie?
Good morning. Really good talking with you. Now, John, how would you describe yourself?
That's a broad question. I guess that generally as an entrepreneur of sorts, in so much as looking at, you know, a variety of opportunities over the years in product development and new technologies, bringing things together from a product point of view and looking for clientele on an international basis, being based out of Hong Kong for many years, led me to, you know, a great variety of product and product development in various areas.
You know, the term entrepreneur, we've been discussing it this morning. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the key elements that make up a good entrepreneur like yourself?
A lot of hard work, a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Well, being unrelenting in seeing something and you know, pursuing it to the end is, I think, a big part of it. A lot of hyperactivity, a lot of you know, the wish to have things done and seeing things be put through. Often it's you're seeing something that somebody else isn't, and then having to, you know, market, convince, and present, and get something across the line so that people can, it actually materializes into something.
Now, I have to mention, you come from business royalty. Your family started 4 and 20 Pies. Was that your dad that started that?
Yes, it was. It was in conjunction with, from the best of my mother's recollections, who's still alive. There were three parties all together. They started in Richmond, in Melbourne, and came up with the idea of the conveyor belt. And I can remember I think I was four at the time. I'm actually investing, I think, the princely sum of about £11,000 in creating the conveyor belt to then start to produce the pies.
That's incredible. Now, what did you learn from that to take you into good stead into your business now?
Well, I guess four was a little bit young, but going forward, it was very much part of my, I guess, both my father and my mother's makeup. Innovation, taking a punt, developing things, and that's, I guess, there's quite a lot of similarities between my father and myself, in so much as that, as I mentioned before, finding something or sort of seeing something in a half light and then bringing it to fruition. He was a forward-thinking man in many ways. He actually brought aluminium to the food business as well.
Oh.
If you remember, if you now look at a meat pie that's kept warm, aluminium was a new product at the time, and it was something that he put together as well as another part of the pie business as such. So, that sort of thing, I guess.
Do you still have any involvement with 4 and 20 pies?
No, not at all. It was sold on to, as I followed a little bit, to Peter's Ice Cream, and then it was sold back to another firm in one of the country cities of Victoria, as I understand it. And then it's mostly moved on again since then.
Do you buy them?
Still do, yeah, of course.
Of course, you've got to have a 4 and 20 at the footy, don't you?
Well, exactly. Well, that was I do remember that as a point. My father coming home with a bottle of champagne, and I literally remember, and they won the contract to supply the MCG, which was the beginning of the volume, basically.
Yes. That would have been an enormous turning point
from
the brand's perspective.
Absolutely.
Now, in your bio, John, it does say that you're a survivor of monumental financial and personal challenges, which I found fascinating. And I suppose rather than go into what they were, but what I'm more interested in is, and our listeners would be as well, how did you overcome these hurdles?
A lot of tenacity, a lot of honesty. I had yes, it's quite true. I was dealing with multinationals, very large, I won't name them, but in the vicinity of $30 to $40 billion corporations, and they took closed down a division, and I got caught in the middle of it. Mm. It was a complete surprise. It was something, you know, you're looking at letter of credit payments and things like that, and all of a sudden that was all terminated, and if you want to challenge us, good luck, which was obviously impossible.
Mm.
So it was a matter of an almighty breath, and then obviously negotiating with creditors and with the constraints that were there, and moving forward, you take a bad thing, and in the simplest answer really is taking a bad thing and finding the good in it and turning it around, which I was able to do. A lot of work, a lot of tenacity, a lot of self-belief, and again, I think one of the greatest elements really was being upfront with everybody and saying, okay, here's the situation, how to work through it. And with that sort of support and attitude, and I was working very much in China at the time, it worked. So I think is the best answer, the most straightforward answer to the question.
Yeah, so most people would have packed their bags and gone home. So I'm always interested to what motivates and drives you to sort of keep going, and that tenacity is, I think, a key element of a true entrepreneur.
Principle being part of it.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Principle being part of it.
Right, okay, yeah, okay. That's a good point. Now, I've also noticed you've worked with many of the world's best-known brands.
Yep.
The list goes on from, and you've worked with one of my favourite being Disney.
Yeah.
But which, out of all the brands that you've worked with internationally, which has been the one that's impressed you the most?
I'd have to say the Walt Disney Company was the most impressive. At the time, it was open to innovation. It was a great company, and particularly through the Imagineering departments out of Florida and then going back to the office. And I sort of used to live between Hong Kong and Los Angeles, literally every 2 weeks backwards and forwards for many years. The opportunity to develop with those guys, because I think of the culture, the type of industry that they're involved in, being you know, creative film and media publishing, consumer products, etc. It was a lot of fun. I mean, we had a ball, and it was very exciting.
It was a good time in the early 90s, wasn't it?
Certainly was.
Yes, and I should mention to our listeners that you won the international rights from the Walt Disney Company for their travel goods and luggage distribution. So, go on.
Yeah, that was one of the major steps. I guess the largest one was I actually came, long story short, but putting sound chips into soft toys and making them shake, rattle, and roll. Was, I put the first chips into Winnie the Pooh, and it became a phenomena. And then, of course, with the library of Disney characters, it became endless as to the opportunities and in categories that that then sprung from. It was, you know, the bringing together of talking and moving technology into what had been a stagnant product, so to speak. Added value, I guess, is the appropriate term.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I didn't know you were going to say Disney, but I'm sort of glad you did, because they are one of my hero brands. So I'm glad you haven't disappointed me.
No, not, and they remain to be, as I'm not involved anymore since moving back to Australia some years ago, a few years ago. But still, a lot of connections there, and it's moved its sort of power base from Los Angeles to New York through different acquisitions, et cetera, but it continues to be impressive.
Now, what are you doing now? What are you up to now?
I'm building buildings here in Australia. I actually, by accident, fell into the business of construction and have had an interesting time in learning rapidly the business of manufacturing goods for the building industry. Principally, I understand the world of production. I've lived with it all my life, so it was a transition in terminologies more than anything else. So, supplying various builders fabricated steel out of China and educating the building industry, which has been a challenge, into the lack of risk in the world of import, basically.
John, I have one of my co-hosts here, Darren Woolley, and he would like to ask you a question.
Please.
Yeah, John, we have offices in Hong Kong and Singapore as well, and okay. been doing business up there for about 8 years.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really interested with the new trade agreement with China, if you have some pearls of wisdom for Australian business people doing business with the Chinese.
Well, sure. The trade agreement is a benefit as such. I think if I'm interpreting you correctly, dealing with China and Chinese and Taiwanese or the Southeast Asia in general, but China in particular, very much face to face in initiating things. You'll find I've found over the years some wonderful relationships. It's China is money and family and money, and it operates on that basis. It's I still find it's still, you know, very personable. You strike up a relationship, you honor your commitments, then you've got loyalty for life. It is a wonderful place to do business. You need to know what you're doing. It's, you know, very important that what you buy is what you get, but then you've got to understand what you're buying to what you end up receiving and developing, et cetera, et cetera. It is cutthroat, but if you're coming across and putting things together properly and honouring obligations, et cetera, I've built relationships that will, you know, extend to my children. I find it, I've been very comfortable there over the years, and have nothing but praise for China on the production side and their ability to the work ethic, the ability to manufacture, and now it moves in from the old days of sort of OEM and you bringing ideas. There's now obviously this decade there's a lot more innovation, and that gap has closed dramatically. So it's changed and will continue to change, but the core element is the there's a loyalty and a consistency there and a very hard working ethic.
Wonderful, John. Really appreciate you sharing your expertise and those pearls of wisdom. Really loved chatting with you, and we really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Look forward to next time.
Okay. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
We hope you're building up your knowledge from the best in the business world on taking care of business. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. We are talking about the risky business of having an entrepreneurial spirit. That, of course, was Bob Seger. And those old enough to remember the movie Risky Business with Tom Cruise. I'm joined here by, with my Spirited Brains Trust, Darren Woolley, Toby Travener, and Jared Carman. If you just joined us, you missed a lot, but podcast will be on the website. John Nick Vapil, that was just on, just before the break. What a fascinating man.
Yeah,
it just could have kept going and going. Might need to get him back on. But Darren, your question about China obviously hit the mark with him. And it was interesting about that family and money. Now, I know you've done quite a bit of work there. Did you find the same?
And also being married to a Chinese woman.
That's right, true.
So I've actually mixed marriage and money. I followed Rupert Murdoch's failed attempt. so far I've made it successful. But yeah. Definitely in China it is about relationships, and family is important.
Yeah.
And money is all about security and securing the future for the family. So he's absolutely right. Building relationships, and even those relationships are around finance, is very important to the Chinese.
And I think that can be quite difficult for Australians to get their head around that. Now, I come from a mixed background as well, with an English father and Japanese mother. And just getting an understanding that there are cultural differences, and the way we practice business here in Australia doesn't necessarily translate all that easily into the other cultures. And whether it's China, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, Southeast Asia or whatever, there's got some subtle nuances. Some of those subtleties you have to, you know, my moral compass has troubles with, where what we would consider to be graft and corruption is just part of greasing the wheels in some locations.
Mm.
And I've seen that across the board as well. But what it always comes down to is, do I know you as a person? How long have I known you for? You know, if there's two people with exactly the same offering, it will go to the cousin, not you.
Interesting. Yeah.
But one of the things that he said was that it's all about face-to-face.
Yes.
And that's interesting, because business in Western society is increasingly, because of the technology, email, social media, things like that. Whereas, you know, it's at the very core of that relationship is actually meeting, sharing food, sharing drinks, you know, getting to know each other.
So if you're thinking about doing business in China, go there.
Absolutely.
Really simple tip.
And there are actual trade delegations that a lot of the cities will organise. And if you can be part of I just finished hosting the Asia Pacific City Summit. And each Australian city will often bring together local businesses and go and visit their sister city or whatever, with the whole focus on building relationships so that business might happen. But the whole idea is, let's build a relationship. Let's get to understand your point of view, how you like to work. And it may take 3 or 4 trips.
Mm.
Before they start saying, well, we're ready to start talking business now.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's eyeballing them, isn't it? John Nick Vapil, that was on just before the break as well, talked about what makes an entrepreneur. And I found some of his comments really fascinating, and particularly how he coped with the hurdles that he has come across. And in his bio, it's very frank. He talked about honesty. Well, that's really clear in his bio. I didn't want to go in. He talks about all his personal struggles and a divorce and all sorts of things that I didn't want to go into in the interview.
Mm.
But I found that honesty, and it was an element I hadn't thought about for being a good entrepreneur. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think personal honesty is really important because it goes to integrity. You know, one of the things he said was, you know, you deliver what you promise to deliver.
Mm.
That's integrity. And being personally honest about what you can and can't do is really important. You know, knowing, being able to accept failure when you fail, learning from it and moving on, is something that gives you a robustness to be able to continue. You know, if you lie to yourself, you're never going to succeed.
And being able to share that vision with the people around you and share your concepts and what you're trying to achieve and being open and honest with them is massive.
Interesting, because entrepreneur, in prep for today, I was thinking about it, and it's got a bit of a shark image to it. You know, when someone says, what do you do? I'm an entrepreneur. And you think, oh, they're a dodgy salesman or something like that. So that's where I found the honesty part interesting. The other bit I found interesting was his tenacity and resilience. So many people just pack their bags and go, you know what, I'm over this, I've had enough, I can't handle this anymore, I'm going home. No, he just sort of get up, dust yourself off and keep going. Do you think that's a key element to being an entrepreneur?
I think so. You hear of people who have failed countless times before they find the thing that works well for them.
Yeah, I think it's actually core to business. You know, if you're not going to be tenacious, you're going to fail in business, as Toby said before. You know, you won't succeed the first year.
Yeah. You'll often find people changing, having to change because the market's changed. Not only has the market changed, our customers' behaviours have changed and what they're needing has changed. And the organisations who have been successful because we've been doing the same thing for the last 75 mm-hmm. years, you know, are starting to struggle now because mm-hmm. everything else has changed around them.
Yes. Tenacity and resilience. You have to be very, very resilient, and there's going to be plenty of knockers and naysayers. You have to roll with it.
You have to roll with it. The other element, I think, that makes a good entrepreneur or having entrepreneurial spirit is being adaptable. Good old Charles Darwin about adaptability. And I was thinking about a company that demonstrates that brilliantly. And I thought about Google and how they continue to adapt, which makes them a leader in their field. But what's your view on adaptability as far as entrepreneurial element?
Google's an interesting choice because it's an engineering company, and they're constantly actually developing things for the purpose of trying to push the boundaries in engineering, and they fail and they succeed and they have momentum. Apple's another interesting one because adaptability is actually taken to the next level, which is being able to adapt to what people want before they even know it.
They're helping us understand what we want.
Yeah.
And look, if we're talking about that sort of technology area, and it'll be interesting to see how they bounce back. But Nokia started off as a timber mill before becoming a rubber manufacturing plant, before moving into handset manufacturer,
right.
telephone
yes.
manufacturer. Now, they're on the verge of irrelevance again.
Yeah, like BlackBerry.
Yeah. So I wonder now what they're going to reinvent themselves as. Now, they sold their business to Microsoft, but not all of it. There's still some engineering in the background, so you never know what's going to come out.
Interesting you mentioned Apple, Darren, because I had leadership as another quality here, an element of being entrepreneurial. And I thought of Steve Jobs. I thought he was a good leader.
Yeah, look, having read the biography and talked to people that have worked with Steve Jobs, he was a visionary. I'm not necessarily sure that's the same as being a good leader, because a great leader actually makes the people around them better than they could be on their own.
Mm. Okay.
And in fact, a lot of his style was very dictatorial. You know, he was demanding of others, but he wasn't necessarily a people grower. He was definitely visionary.
Okay, I'm crossing him off my leadership list and putting him to visionary. Now, who is a good leader?
But I'm just thinking what made really huge sense in the way he worked, and where a lot of leaders do work, is that they're very good at describing the light on top of the hill. And you mentioned it in real estate and growing your business from 4 to 24 earlier as an example. If you're very clear on what the light on top of the hill is, people will help you get there. But if you just tell them what the next rock they need to go on, if we're using that analogy, that's all they'll do. And they won't have any idea where the next step is. And therefore, the innovation and the ideas won't come about because you form this dictatorial viewpoint, which is, I want you to do this. It's management, not leadership.
But wouldn't a leader be one that actually grows groups of people that also define a vision?
A leader brings out the best in people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So who's a good leader that we know of?
Well,
high profile.
Can I say somebody who's very high profile now, but was high profile in the work he did before, was probably the current Governor General. And I've got to get the naming right. Governor General, His Excellency the Governor General,
General.
Peter Cosgrove, right? So, but he was very clear on what needed to be done.
Yes.
He set the expectations.
Yeah.
He provided outcome focus to his people and then let him do it. He would let them do it.
Yeah.
So he comes to mind very well. And he was a very, very gracious man in how he worked as well, and giving credit where credit was due.
Just to finish up, a little pearl of wisdom?
As far as entrepreneurial spirit, if you've got some in you, give it a go. It's pretty cheap to do nowadays. The risk is actually fairly low. But everything about entrepreneurs, everyone talks about, you've got a great life, look at that, the 4-hour working week and all that kind of stuff is rubbish.
That's what John said. You've got to work hard.
You've got to work hard.
Absolutely. If you're going into business, any sort of business, be driven by your passions, because in your passion you will find the innovation that is going to make you a successful business person.
Jared, yep. A pearl of wisdom to leave us with?
Yeah, work hard, have the end in mind, and surround yourself with great people.
Have the end in mind, I like that too. I would like to thank you, Toby Travenar, Darren Woolley, Jared Carman. Wonderful to have you here, and of course, John Nick Vapil. Thank you also to Steve, great show, and Rab, all that clicking in the background, photos. So there'll be lots of photos on the Facebook page, and we're also videoed, so hopefully it's a VOD, is it a VOD pod?
Vodcast.
Anyway, we hope you've heard lots of good advice today and inspiration. Don't forget, you can see Taking Care of Business on Sky Business News on Tuesdays at 2:30, as well as on Facebook and Twitter, we're everywhere. All entrepreneurs appear to be young at heart. Here is some fun to see us into the weekend. We look forward to your company next Friday at 11 a.m. In the meantime, keep taking care of your business.